Greetings and salutations. My name is Tyler Ellenick, and this is Raven's Rule, the podcast where we chronicle all things 90s camera. In this episode, I speak with Chris Page of Glengarry, Ontario's The Stan GT. So I've read a lot of band biographies, and I think yours might be the first where the words chicken coop appear as your humble beginning. Can you maybe walk me through that and how Stan GT evolved from a chicken coop to putting out records all over the world?
Yeah, for sure. It's always been a bit of a calling card for us, the whole chicken coop thing. But really, the way it started out is when the band started in 1985. We were just teens, and we lived in the sticks, really, in a place called Glengarry County, and it's between Ottawa and Montreal. And you know, there was really nowhere for us to rehearse at the time, so we would borrow our parents' vehicles and go to school. Sometimes we're able to get a portable building to rehearse in, or but when we were in high school, we used the cafeteria for a while. We were always looking for a place, and my parents had a small hobby farm, and there's a bunch of outbuildings, and one of them was an old chicken coop. And so we fixed that up into a bit of a clubhouse and used that. But the only problem was in the wintertime, it wasn't heated or anything. So in the wintertime, we had to continue sort of traveling around the county trying to find places to rehearse. So it was funny because from a very young age, we were always packing up our gear, going to a place, setting up our gear, rehearsing, tearing down, and then traveling home again. So it's like we were always touring, even when we were young kids. But the chicken coop is a funny thing because everyone has always asked us about that because it was a chicken coop. I mean, it's a funny thing, but that's exactly what it was. We turned it into our own clubhouse, though. Really, it was a pretty great space because you're out in the middle of nowhere and we could play as loud as we wanted. You know,
was there any kind of aroma left over from previous tenants of the space?
Yeah, wasn't that bad, but I wouldn't say it was aroma, but it certainly had the vibe of an old barn, you know. So that made it kind of cool, but it was pretty dungy and dirty, and we had little carpets up on the walls and stuff to absorb some of the sound. And in the springtime, I remember a couple of times the floors would flood, and we actually would rehearse standing on 2x6s, above the water, which is probably not the smartest thing to do. We joked about that in the past. It's funny we didn't electrocute ourselves, but it was sort of our home for a long time.
So you said you guys were right in between Ottawa and Montreal. I'm curious, did you follow each of those music scenes, or did you gravitate more to one city or over the other?
We definitely gravitated towards Montreal. We were closer to Montreal. There's a place, a little village called Lancaster on the 401, and that's where the three of us were from that started the band, Doug, Glenn, and I. From a very young age, from the time that we were able to get access to vehicles, so let's say 15, because we had some older friends who were 16 and used to drive, and we would go to Montreal and sneak into clubs to see bands. And in those days, it was really easy. I mean, the drinking age was 18, but you could get into a bar in Quebec when you were 15. It wasn't difficult. So, we were always driving down to Montreal and seeing shows. And, that's where we got exposed to, the Og record scene, right, with the Gruesomes and Deja Voodoo. And, then Pipeline Records had 3 o'clock Train and Jerry and the Sons of Rhythm Orchestra. So we would go see these shows, and, they were our rock stars, right? They were our idols, and we really looked up to them. And Ottawa, not so much. We played Ottawa a couple of times, but I live in Ottawa now, and I've lived here for a long time. But in those days, I didn't really know Ottawa very well. And, it was much more of a Montreal thing. Ottawa just seemed so much further away.
I'm curious, of those Montreal bands you mentioned, was there one that really struck a chord with you?
Early on, the Gruesomes, for sure. It was an interesting story, this, for me anyway. Glenn, our a drummer is really into cool, weird music in those days, much more so, I would say, than Doug and I. And he's the one that exposed us to all that stuff. So, you know, we were, again, teens, and he got tickets to see the Cramps and took me. And I was blown away. And, you know, to this day, I'm like, I feel so fortunate I got to see the Cramps. And then Screaming Blue Messiahs opened that show. It was this band from England. And they were coming back another week. I think it was a week or two later. So, and the tickets were $5. So we went back to see them play. And the Gruesomes and Deja Vu to open that show. So, and when I saw the Gruesomes, I was completely, you know, blown away. And I think, you know, I've talked to a lot of, especially Canadian artists across Canada who are influenced by the Gruesomes. And so I was really taken with them. But I would have to say, you know, 3 o'clock Train and both 3 o'clock Train and Jerry were really important to us as well. Different styles of music, which is really interesting. You know, Jerry was sort of rock and roll and surf, and 3 o'clock Train were very much alt country before there was alt country. You know, but yeah, those are the three that come to mind. And then another important band for us was the Ripcords.
Your mama wears all the boots, but man, she looks so cool. Even though I know she's born way back in 62. Your mama wears all the boots, but man, she looks so cool. She's the queen of the baby boom. I fell in love with her the first time that we ate. But I watched her laugh her lips around the fork and start to masturbate. And you know, your mama wears all the boots, but man, she looks so cool. 17 spot Roger, who's breaking all the rules. Your mama wears all the boots, but man, she looks so cool. She makes my heart go boom. I was about to beat my lust, I can't deny. Alpha laser 32 whole dogs up to a size. Your mama wears on the boots, but man, she looks so cool. Now I like to visit her when you're off at school. Your mama wears on the boots, but man, she looks so cool. She makes my parts go boom. Let's pass me to her room to help her with her hair. She strokes it and she teases it high, way high into the air. Watch magic fingers swirl, I find I make the rise. Watch his standing tone down from Moloch to the high. You know, your mama wears all the boots, but man, she looks so cool. Leather's bright and attitude, blow me through and through. Your mama wears all the boots, but man, she looks so cool. Makes my parts go boom.
Friends with Paul Gott, who started On Guard Records, and that's where the whole thing started, where we started to put out records, and eventually our first big tour was with the Ripcords, and they were very, very much on the punk side of things, right? So yeah, I think it just evolved over time.
Yeah, let's walk through that a little bit. How did how and when did things first start happening for you guys, where you got close to releasing your first music to the public?
I think the biggest thing was going to these shows and getting to know these bands. We started in 85. Our first live show in a club was late 87, which is a long time when you're a teenager. We played a place called Station 10, which was a a jumping off point for a lot of young bands then in Montreal. And so we got a show or two there. And I think the second one we played, a couple of the guys from the Gruesomes came to the show and then asked us if we would open for them Halloween night. For the record launch. Yeah, it was huge. It was a huge deal at Les Fufun. It was packed, sold out. And it was, yeah, it was amazing. So it was just really nice. You know, all the folks in those bands were super friendly and kind and helpful. And they just kind of, you know, they got us on that bill, which was great. And then I would say maybe a year or two later, so we're getting closer to 1990, I guess. We played Deja Voodoo Barbecue, which is another thing that I love having on the resume, because when we were teens, we used to go see those things, and they were just, I don't know if you heard of what that was, but it was Deja Voodoo around Christmas time would do this big sort of little mini festival and have all these bands on the bill. And they would either like do barbecue chicken or gumbo or something. And it was like free food and all these awesome bands. So we would go to that often. Every year if we could. I think I don't remember how many they had, but what, about 5 years or something. And we were on one of the last ones. And it was at that show that the Ripcords played. And that's where we met Paul Gott. And he was like, where are you guys from? We're like, yeah, we're from the Sticks. And it became a bit of a joke throughout our entire existence that, you know, we were this sort of farm guys from the middle of nowhere. But yeah, and then after that, Paul had just started En Garde, and he started putting out our records, which was very helpful, because then, you know, you start to get played on college radio, and then doors start opening up where you can go play shows in different cities and stuff like that.
And you said the Ripcords took you on your first Canadian tour, or your first tour around Quebec or Ontario? Or
it was our first Canadian. It was cross Canada. Oh, wow. We did in summer of 92, I think it was. And it was the Ripcord's first cross Canada tour as well. Hmm. And Paul was really instrumental in setting all of that up. You know, the only thing we needed to do at the time was buy a van. We didn't have one. So we got that. And then we just sort of rode their coattails across the country and back. And we learned a lot, right? You learned how to book shows and you make all these friends. I mean, you make friends for life when you do that thing. It amazes me that all these people that I met back then, I'm still friends with, you know, online. And it was just, yeah, it was a real sense of camaraderie, and it's a lot of fun. And, yeah, it was our first big one. And we did many, many more after that on our own. But, yeah, it was Paul that really, really organized all of that in the beginning.
Now, Ripcord is going to have a harder edge, at least, you know, harder edge punk style than you guys, more melodic. How was the fan reaction to you guys playing with the Ripcords? Because it's might be a little bit of a punk divide between the two styles.
Yeah. Oh, there definitely was. There's no question. You know, they pulled out their crowd, and it was very, very punk crowd, but we were always really accepting, I would say.
Cool.
To the hardcore punks. You know, we certainly didn't look the part, but we played pretty fast and loud, and you're right, it's a different style than the Ripcords, but yeah, we always got along really well, famously, and enjoyed playing with them. And yeah, they've got an amazing fan base, you know, and they're very, very accepting of us. So it was fun.
Now, you guys started out as the Stand, I think, but then you added the GT at some point. Do I have that right? Or was it always the Stand GT?
No, you're right. It was the Stand for quite a while. And, you know, in those pre-internet, pre-cell phone days, there was another band in California called The Stand that we found out about. And it's really weird, because at some point, I was trying to remember the story, but at some point I got a letter from them. I have to see if I can find that. And they sent us a letter and said, it was a nice letter, but it was a little on the passive aggressive side, I think, if I remember correctly, saying, you know, we're on a major label, and you know, we have cassettes out, and we've had this name. You know, they're like, it's okay if you keep the name, but, you know, we have the name too. And, yeah, we were just like, oh, so we kind of did what, you know, Dinosaur Jr. did, adding the Jr. when there was another dinosaur, apparently. So we were trying to come up with something like that. And so we just, at the time we were, you know, we were sort of using the muscle car thing. So we're like, oh yeah, GT, like the muscle car. So that's where that came from. I honestly, like, I never liked, I'll be honest, I never really liked the name. Like, we named our band when we were 15 years old because it was a Stephen King book on our shelf, you know? And, like, it just stuck. And then we added the GT, and then it was like, and then sometimes, and it's funny, you pointed out to me how on Spotify, a couple of our albums aren't lumped in with the band's page because the is missing. So I have to go in and try to figure out how to fix that. It's just Stan GT as opposed to the Stan GT.
Right, yeah.
So there was all that confusion going on. But anyway, it is what it is. It's funny.
What name would you have went with had you had the ability to change it at some point? Because I know Rainbow Butt Monkeys changed it at some point to Finger 11. What would you have went with?
Well, that's a really good question. In terms of having the in front, I always put the because to me, the name of the band has always been The Stand, and I still just, that's the way I refer to it, right? You know, the GT sort of went on through all our albums, really. But yeah, to me, it's just always been The Stand.
When you got back from that first Cross Canada tour, what was your guys' next step? I mean, were you working towards getting together, you know, to finding a record label home to further your career, or were you happy with On Guard, or what was your kind of plan as a band at that point, or were you just kind of going with the flow?
I would say definitely going with the flow. We were never really interested in a major label, especially at that time. It wasn't really a goal of ours. I think we were all childhood friends. We enjoyed hanging out. We enjoyed traveling in a van together. Like, I think we did 7 major tours. I was thinking back, and I don't think we ever had an argument, which is unbelievable, right? Huh. You know, we just got along famously, so it was a lot of fun. We enjoyed making music. We enjoyed going out and playing. But when we got back from that first tour, I think we were pretty eager to try to get back out again. And it was around that time that we'd done Blur Your Cool, which is sort of the first release, I would say, like official. We had one called Another Round, which was kind of an EP that came out first, but then Blur Your Cool was the one that only ever came out on cassette. But that's the tape that really went around and got us introduced to a lot of different people. So we were able to, you know, it opened doors for us. Like, there was a guy named Alan Wright who had a fanzine in Kingston, Ontario, and he wrote a really great fanzine. And he saw us play in Ottawa at one point. By coincidence, he moved to Seattle and took that tape with him and gave it to some of his friends there who was starting a label called Top Drawer. And so that whole connection happened with us in Seattle. We spent a lot of time going there. We recorded our first full-length album there with Kurt Block from the Fastbacks. And it was just sort of these doors opening for us, right? The only unfortunate thing was, you know, to drive to Seattle from where we are. Yeah. It was, so, you know, we would plan these tours around going to Seattle, which is kind of what we did. And it was, yeah, it was just so far away. You know, I've talked to some, I remember Grant from the Smugglers saying to me, like, why didn't you guys go play New York more often? Like, I don't know. Yeah. Hindsight's 2020, but we really should have spent a lot more time on the East Coast as opposed to the West. But anyway.
Now, well, I want to dive a little bit deeper into the Seattle connection, but before that, you mentioned like a little reviews, and I think you posted one on your website about, was there an info line to call in and hear your music? Cause that's so 1990s if that's true, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny. That's a review I found recently out of the Montreal Gazette. Mark Lepage I think he still writes. I don't think he writes for the Gazette anymore, but he was a real big independent music supporter. So, I mean, we were a no name band. We weren't even from Montreal. We give him this cassette and he reviews it in this major newspaper. Right. And yeah, you could actually call. And if you, I think you, there's a code that you enter and you can listen to a bit of the record, a bit of the cassette. So they would have had to take that cassette. Right. And then, I don't know how they would have played it. Like, how did they record it and then get it on the phone? I'm just like, this is amazing.
Yeah, some poor intern there just waiting for the phone to ring and then they hit play in the cassette.
Yeah. It's a pretty good little story. I was surprised to find that. I just forgot that they did that. They talk about supporting independent bands. Like, that's amazing.
And then Blur Your Cool, I was listening to it the other day, and the track that I really dig on there is Jamie's Mile. Song or
to be honest, I don't really remember. I don't think there's a story necessarily behind it. I mean, a lot of the writing I do is more anecdotes put together to create a story. Like, I don't really write from a perspective of an entire story, but I know for sure the name Jamie came from my friend who she was in journalism school with me in Montreal, Jamie Orchard, and she actually went on to do some pretty amazing things in journalism and was an anchor at Global and stuff. But that's where the name came from. But I don't I don't really remember in terms
of
what.
No, that's fair. It's a long time ago, man.
You know, it's a fun one for sure. And I know we played it a long time and quite a lot in the early days. And I think, if I remember correctly, the one that we just put on Bandcamp anyway, it's not on Spotify yet, but. Another Round, the cassette that came out before Blue Your Cool, that one also has a different version of Jamie's Mile on it, and it's even more out of control. And Doug's playing slide guitar on it, of all things. It's really weird. But when I heard it, and I hadn't heard it in probably 30 years, I was like, wow, this is really intense. So I'll have to send you that link so you can compare the two. Yeah.
Now, Seattle, what year did you Did you get down there to hang out with Kurt and make the Magically Delicious?
Yeah, it was I think the summer of 94, but we had been there. We got there our second tour. I think we went to Seattle and hung out with those Top Drawer guys. They were Ian from Sicko, the band from there, and yeah, that was pretty amazing because he knew Kurt, and so he gave Kurt the cassette, and Kurt was like, "Oh yeah, this is great. I'll record these guys for sure." We went to the famous Egg Studios, Conrad Uno's studio there, and which is Pop Lammer Records. So it was pretty cool to be there and meeting all these folks. And yeah, I mean, the recording session with Kurt was really awesome and a dream. And we learned so much. And we got to play with the Fastbacks a few times, who were just phenomenal. And I remember one time, we were out there. I don't know if it was the same. Might have been the same trip, but we had a show at the Crocodile, and I think it was Sicko was supposed to play with us, and they couldn't for some reason. So we had no local band to play with us, and we were like, you know, we're out of towners, nobody knows us. And so Kurt's like, "Oh, that's fine," and he just gets on the phone and starts calling the guys from the Young Fresh Fellows. Huh. And they're like, "Oh yeah, we'll just use your gear and we'll play the set." Like, they're like, "Oh, that's so amazing." So Young Fresh Fellows headlined the show, obviously. We got to open and the place was packed because it was the Fellows, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was pretty amazing stuff. Yeah. They were just so kind. And, I remember one time we were in the studio with Kurt and he said, "Oh, can you guys, you're going to the store. Can you do me a favor? Can you pick up a six pack of, I think it was PBR or something." And he said, knock on this address, go to this address, knock on the door and give the guy the six pack." Like, okay. So we go knock on the door, door opens and it's Scott McCoy. And he's like, he's working in the Pop Llama office, like packaging up records and sending them. And he's like, "Oh, hey, how's it going? Come on in, guys." And he shows us around, gives us some records. And yeah, it's pretty funny.
Now, Seattle in the '90s, of course, is you know, legendary. I mean, did you get like a sense talking to legit locals who went through that whole craziness about that craziness and about all the hype around that city, or was did those conversations come up at all?
They did, for sure, and we were all extremely fascinated by all of that, obviously. But by that time, 94 or so, you know, it had started to really blow over, right? So mm-hmm. we were sort of there at the end of it. And yeah, I mean, it was a lot of the local people were really, I think they always felt weirded out by it all. They're like, it's, you know, it was strange to them. I mean, obviously we heard lots of stories about Nirvana and stuff like that. And it was such a tiny, tiny little scene, right? With everybody, you know, helping each other out. And then all of a sudden the world attention was on it. I think it was just a strange thing for a lot of them. And, you know, so it was, it's not like, I don't know. It wasn't like it was necessarily a good thing, you know, in a weird way.
Now, were you there in 94 after Kurt's death or before?
When did he die? 94.
I think it was April of 94.
Oh, okay, yeah. So we were there in August of 94.
So that's pretty shortly after. Was there like a...
Yeah.
The city had to be in...
I think the city was probably in shock. I think it was probably a dark cloud, yeah. I would say. I don't really remember, to be honest with you. But I'm sure there was. I mean, there was still that awful dark cloud about Mia Zapata as well, right? I remember
that
story too. And that was something that really lingered there as well. Yeah, for sure. And a friend of ours took us up to where, you know, just to do a drive by the place where Kurt lived. And yeah, it's incredibly sad. But yeah, I'd forgotten that it was right around the same time. And we at one point the Top Drawer guys got Alice Wheeler, the photographer, to do photos of us. And she was actually really good friends with Kurt Cobain. So kind of at the time, like this is again, pre-internet, right? So, you know, you don't have all this information. And she was the one telling us like how he was just completely weirded out by the whole thing. She said one time he, I think they were going back to play in Seattle, and the label sent a limo or something, and she went, and she said like she got in the limo, and it was, you know, he was all embarrassed by it and stuff. So yeah, I just never got the impression, I mean, obviously I'm an outsider, but I never got the impression that it was, everyone was really excited about the whole thing, right? It was just weird.
Right.
Yeah, I mean the whole grunge scene. Obviously Kurt's death was super sad, but
so when you go to Seattle all the way from the sticks, as you called it, without the backing of a major label, I mean, how are you surviving down there? How long are you down there? Did you just take out credit cards or borrow money from mom and dad, or how are you guys living day to day there while you record the record?
Yeah, certainly no money from mom and dad. my parents, all our parents, I would say, were very supportive of us. But yeah, we had to be self-sufficient. So what we do is we just go home, work jobs, save up money, and then get in the van and go, and then try to break even. And yeah, being in the States in those days, yeah, the dollar wasn't good for sure. And we had one big tour plan that fell through. So we only really ever went down as far as Portland. And we didn't really get down to California. So we didn't play a lot down there. We played Seattle a lot, but I still remember when that tour fell through for whatever reason. I don't remember why, but, I mean, there's such incredibly different times without the access to the internet and stuff. But we drove straight home from Seattle. We're like, you know what, let's just go home. And we got on whatever that interstate is that goes from Seattle to Boston. Can't remember which one it is, I-80 or something, 85 or whatever it is. And we drove 55 hours straight. So I know that it takes 55 hours to get from Seattle to where we were from in Glengarry.
That's hardcore. Yeah.
Yeah.
And no fights either, man. That's amazing.
No, I will say on that trip, I think we started to get a little cranky by the end of it because we were rotating drivers and sleeping in the back. I think everyone was pretty tired. But no, yeah, we always got along famously, which is great.
You mentioned Grant Lawrence there just a little bit ago. Can you talk about, you know, maybe the impact him and the Smugglers had on you guys, and, you know, taking you guys across, because they were, you know, road dogs as well.
Yeah, I was going to say they were hugely big influence on us for sure. And they were road dogs way more than us even. And I didn't really realize until I read Grant's book that, you know, they'd done a lot before we did that tour. Like, I didn't realize how much touring they had already done. And, I think it was, I'm trying to remember the connection, how we first got hooked up with them. It was one of our, I think probably the first tour we did on our own. We got onto a Mint bill. I think it was Mint's 5th anniversary or something, and Cobb and the Smugglers played that, and that's how we got to know them. And then I guess we just made friends, and at some point we were able to jump on that tour with them. So they came out east, and then we got on the tour with them and played like Kingston, Toronto, and then started heading west. And then we went to the States afterwards when they went home to Vancouver. But yeah, for sure. I mean, we got along so well with them, and it was a lot of fun. And it was interesting because Colin, our bass player, his dad had a video camera, which is pretty unheard of back then. And we brought it with us on that tour. So I have like hours of footage of stuff. I put some of it up on YouTube, but I have like live Smugglers, Huevos Rancheros, different bands that we played with. And yeah, and just all kinds of weird footage of us driving around in a van, you know? So it's kind of fun to have that and digitize some of it. Yeah,
it's amazing. I mean, I've, you know, just like I wish I would have took more still pictures in the 90s, let alone video, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's so few photos. Like, it's unbelievable how, I'm just like, why don't we have more photos of the stuff we did? I think Paul Gott from the Ripcords is great at documenting. He's got tons of stuff. And I think Grant was pretty good as well. I mean, obviously, based on that book, like, he kept a great diary.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading that. It's an excellent book.
And you guys make an appearance of that book as well. Tell the folks about your appearance in the Smugglers or in the tour diaries.
Yeah, it was at the end of the tour, and we were playing in Penticton, and when we went on stage, we asked one of the smugglers to film us. So we said, can you take the video camera and shoot some footage of the show? And so they did. Thankfully, they caught some of it. But then they went outside to our van, and this is all on my YouTube channel. And they had bought a bale of hay, and they just covered our van in hay, like stuffed it in all the, you know, windows and all over the place. And then when we got off stage, they said, come on out, we have a surprise for you. Thanks for touring with us. And our, you know, and there's our reaction with the van covered in hay. So it was pretty funny. And they always like made fun of us, calling us farmers and stuff. But it was all in good fun.
Did they get ripped off on their on the price they paid for that bale?
Yeah, they did, for sure. I think I say that to Grant at the end of the video. I forget what they, I think they paid $5, which is probably only worth $1, but anyway.
And how long did it take to, did anything get in the cracks and stuff like that? Were you finding, you know, strands weeks later?
Yeah, there were seeds all over the place. And we were really paranoid about crossing the border with that. So we we found, I forget, somebody had a relative out in Abbotsford or something like that, I think. And we vacuumed the van out before we crossed the border.
I was reading your discography, and you guys, you know, you had records released all over the world, like what I think was, you know, 3 or 4 countries, and a lot of smaller labels. I mean, how was it in the 90s? How did you get those connections where you were like jumping around to this indie, to that indie, to this indie, you know, getting it international? I mean, can you maybe walk people through that? I mean, who don't really know that experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was really difficult for sure. And it was word of mouth, and it was writing lots of letters. And then at some point I did get a fax machine at my parents' house, and that came in handy. So you're able to fax, you know, if like say we're working with an artist, like Pat Moriarty, for example, did the Magically Delicious. He would fax what he was working on, you know, so we could see it. But yeah, it was really difficult because, you know, you send a letter, send a cassette, and then you wait for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I think Radio Blast in Germany, they did a 7-inch with us. I think that's how it happened. It's just we had heard about this label, and this guy was doing records, and you know, we would have said hi in a letter. This is us. You know, what do you think? We have some songs. And like to get all of that to come together was really, yeah, it's pretty amazing to think how long it took to do that stuff. And bouncing around to different indies was really only because there are very few of them that, you know, had much of a budget. And so you kind of need to bounce around because somebody like Radio Blast would put out a 7-inch and then move on to another band. And it's not like we would expect Radio Blast to keep putting out our records. Like it didn't work that way then. And so the Top Drawer thing, that happened and it was great, but they again kind of ran out of money and they weren't able to do our second record. And the second record was going to be on Mint, Apocalypse Cow. But, and it's funny, in the Mint book, Bill from Mint even says, yeah, why didn't we do that record? So it's just the lack of communication was pretty, it's pretty comical, really. And yeah, I don't know why, you know, because they did a 7-inch with us. And then we were like, okay, let's do this record. And it ended up being on Lance Rock, which is from Nanaimo, BC. Which is awesome because he also had it released on Get Hip in the States, which was pretty cool. But yeah, it seemed every time we would get something out and then we would be ready to do something else, you would have to, you know, look around and see who could help you put out the records. But it was fun. It was a fun thing. And I mean, we, you know, made a lot of friends and met a lot of different people through those contacts.
And how would the, like the payment be structured? I mean, would you sign like, you know, because I kind of get the idea, you know, behind major labels, they sign these big record deals and all these, you know, big numbers floating around. But for an indie, for a one-off, how does that kind of payment plan structure? How do you kind of, what's the kind of contract look like?
It was usually in those days, it was just an agreement to press X number of records and the band would get a percentage of the records to sell off the stage. It's usually the way it worked. So Munster Records in Spain put out their Magically Delicious. That's what they did. They said, you know, we're going to press, we'll only press 500 and we'll give you 50 or something like that. That's kind of the way it worked. There was never really money exchanging hands. It just wasn't enough records being sold. And I think we did sign a little bit of an agreement with Jack at Lance Rock, and it was very fair. Like he just said, like, it was something like, I want to just make sure that I could continue to sell this record for X number of years. Like maybe it was 10 years or something. It was just an agreement to say, like, you know, if I repress it, he would probably give us copies. And then, but he had the option to keep repressing it if he wanted to, which was totally fair. Like it wasn't one of these, you know, because you hear the nightmares about the major label in perpetuity contracts, right, that people would sign. And it's horrible. So thankfully, we were never, ever in a situation like that. It was always very indie, very fair, you know. And there just, unfortunately, there just wasn't much money because it was so expensive to do everything, right?
Right.
So it's not like we were getting checks from any of these labels, that's for sure. Yeah, very underground.
So along with Apocalypse Cow, I mean, that takes us to like the mid-90s, and Much Music really has a stronghold on, you know, alternative rock, and it's really making rock stars out of people in this country. Through the music video and through the Much environment, how important was it for you guys to try to get money together to make a music video and try to get it on Much Music?
It was a thought because we did do a video for Mudsick. I've got a way through this. I've got a way through this thing soon. But again, to do a video in those days, holy, it was so expensive and so difficult to do. So the way, and I thought, you know, yeah, we got to try to do a video. So we had friends that had access to cameras, and they came out and filmed us on Doug's farm. And it's actually Doug's family pretending to be the band in that video, which is pretty fun. and then, to edit the video together, one of those friends of a friend had access to, at Ryerson in Toronto, had access to an editing suite where he could go in and put the video together. And I remember going down to Toronto and then going in with him and doing it. We were doing it all, you know, on a shoestring budget without like really no money. And once the video was done, we did get it on Much Music because I had a friend who worked there.
Nice.
So it played, like it got aired at some point. So you're right. It was really important. But in those days, there was a lot of doors you had to get through. And so if you weren't part of sort of the major label or big label system, it was really, really hard. And, you know, you could apply for grants and get all this money, but like thousands and thousands of dollars, which was like, to me today, it's unbelievable, you know, because I, you know, our Expand Fuzz project, for example, we just did, we did a video on our iPhones and edited it on our desktop, you know, yeah. And it just blows me away that, that the money that was being thrown around back then, but you had to have access and you had to have an in somewhere. And it was difficult for us because we were never part of a scene necessarily. Like we gravitated towards the Montreal scene, but we weren't ever really in it. So it was, I think, a little bit more difficult for sure.
Yeah. I was watching that Mudsick video and, yeah, in the same way that Clerks is charming, the you know, the Kevin Smith debut, that video is charming to me. You know, it's just like super low budge, black and white. You know mm-hmm. everybody there is because they want to be there. You know, it just gives you good vibes watching it with a good song.
Yeah, it's super fun. And I remember being really proud of the shot where somebody was up on top of the van shooting down on the motorcycle. And we're like, oh, wow, that's so great. It looks like we have a boom. Yeah, it was really fun and silly, but we had a blast making it for sure. The other video that we did, The Weight, which only just came out about a year ago, there's an interesting story behind that one too, because a friend of ours, again, had access to a camera, a Concordia, I think in 1992. He shot all that footage. I can't remember the folks involved, but he knew this woman that had access and she helped. It was all these people just helping. We shot this footage and we really liked it. We always loved it. We had edited it. We sort of did a rough edit at some point by hand, like writing down, I think they're called rushes. So we were like writing down the numbers and where the clips would go. So I had these pieces of paper that I kept for however long that is, almost 30 years. And then now, because I can do this on my desktop, I was able to finally digitize it, get it into my computer, and edit it the way we envisioned it back then.
That's amazing.
And put it out. Yeah, so it was really cool. It was like such an awesome sense of, you know, hanging on to this stuff, but like a sense of accomplishment to get it done. And yeah, and I always really liked that video. So at least I think we have two videos anyway.
Now, because of, like you were saying, the difficulties of an indie band, you know, let alone making a video, let alone getting it played on much music. With Apocalypse Cow, was it really, were you focused on trying to get a major label involved at any level?
Yeah, no, I can pretty much say no, we never really did that. I mean, I think we probably dreamt of being on a bigger American indie, you know, at the time, like say Merge Records or something like that. Like I sent almost all our records to Merge in the early 90s, just because I really liked the label. I liked Superchunk and that type of thing. But in terms of a major, it never really occurred to us. Maybe it just wasn't really our scene. It wasn't what we looked up to. It was more the those cool American indies, right, that we kind of idolized and looked up to and, you know, jumped to being on, like maybe a Matador or something like that, right, which was our pipe dream. Major labels like Warner Brothers or something, it just never really was never an interest, I would say. But I think I also have thought about this a lot as well. And when we started out, we didn't really have a lot of interest in necessarily, or we didn't think that we could make a living at it or make money at it. It was more about having a good time, having fun, being creative. Sounds romantic to say that, but it's true. Like that was our only ambition at the time. And I think when Nirvana happened and then Green Day happened, it started to get a little weird because they were like, oh, like maybe we can be on a label and maybe we can do cool things, you know? So I think there was a time period there where we started to think along those lines a little bit and maybe try to tour a little bit harder or do a little bit more, but you know, it never panned out in that way for us. And in hindsight, I'm glad it didn't, because, you know, we have access to all our music. We can control all our music and there's, you know, still people interested in the music and the back catalog and stuff. So I prefer it that way, you know, and having it tied up with some major label somewhere, you know, because there was a lot of horror stories back then of bands getting signed and then just getting completely destroyed in the machine, you know.
I think my favorite tune off Apocalypse Cow is Crank Down the Window.
Okay. I was actually just listening to that one as a trying to think about Deep Cuts. I hadn't heard that song in a long time.
What did you think about it listening back to it recently?
A lot of memories came back with that song. I remember writing it and feeling really good about that song. It was just that chorus part where, you know, there's like sort of shouting in the background. I'd forgotten about that. Like, oh, this is interesting the way this is mixed. But yeah, it was good to hear that again for sure. And I think that's when we were really, that was kind of the peak of the band. Like we were firing on all cylinders, touring a lot. And we recorded that record in Montreal with our friend Rod Shearer, who was a big champion of the band early on. We met him late 80s. I think he was one of the sound techs at Station 10. He's an Australian guy. And he just loved us, right? He's like, you remind me so much of all the Australian punk bands back home. And, you know, I want to record you one day. And he recorded us a few times, but he was like a big supporter and really, and I think we had done a lot of the Magically Delicious songs with him early on. And then we went to Seattle and did the record with Kurt. And I think he was kind of bummed out that happened. But then, you know, we did Apocalypse Cow with him. And I really think that record is pretty much peak, you know. The next one that came along, Good on the River, is great as well. But the band just wasn't, we weren't touring as much. And I remember it wasn't really, I think it's a great accomplished record, but we weren't necessarily together all the time making it. You know, I was doing, you know, a lot of, Doug would come in and play his parts and then go home. And I would just work with our friend Dave Draves to put it all together type of thing. But yeah, Apocalypse Cow for sure is pretty good.
I'm curious, you said you worked on a lot of the Magically Delicious songs with another producer first before you recorded with Kurt. With Kurt, with the Fastbacks, I mean, you know, he's, you know, legendary band. Did you notice the influence that he put on those songs, like his touch? How did he improve them, or did you notice an improvement?
I don't know if I would say improvement, but different for sure. Like his style, you could hear it, right? It's like, it's very, like, I love the Fastback sound. And Kurt told us that he, for years, when he was, you know, with going into studios with other producers or engineers, he said he would get frustrated because he just couldn't get the sound he wanted. So that's where he learned to do it himself. So he was like self-taught, and you could really hear it on those later Fastbacks records. You know, he's at the controls. And I think that, you know, we have that guitar sound that Kurt really likes, and we were using some of the gear there too. So it definitely has his polish on it, I would say. And I think the earlier versions of those songs are a little dirtier and grittier. But yeah, Kurt was really good at polishing sort of the pop punk sound, you know, which Ian from Sicko reminded me, we went out to Seattle a couple of years ago to play a festival, and he was reminding me of how like that style of music, just there wasn't a lot of it in those days. It was, you know, Fastbacks for sure, Sicko, and then a handful of other bands. It was like pre-Green Day, right?
Right.
And once Green Day hit, they were everywhere. But, and so that's how we sort of connected as well, because he said, you know, we were like kindred spirits. Mm-hmm. We're trying to find bands that were similar. And yeah, and Kurt was a big part of that, I would say, for sure. With his touch and his ears.
Now, you mentioned not really being, you know, interested in, you know, the major label scene, but you did play some gigs with major label bands. How did those kind of, like Moist, for example, how do those kind of gigs happen?
Yeah, that's actually kind of a funny story, because I don't think Moist were on a label at that point. I think they were still just an indie band. Yeah, but we played, it was a interior BC somewhere, I think it was Cranbrook maybe. There was a festival in an arena, that's like a hockey arena, but the it was summertime, so the ice wasn't in, and it was on the floor, and Moist was on that bill. And the reason why I remembered is because we had their bumper sticker on the inside of our van, right? And so we were like, "Yeah, this band Moist that we play with." And then of course they blew up and became huge. But yeah, it was kind of like that. It was like accidental. And it was another band I was trying to think of back bands that, you know, got really big after we played with them. And Me, Mama, Margaret was another one. We played with them when they just started, and we were played at Tiny Cafe with them. And then they invited us to play a show when they started to get huge in Toronto at El Macombo. And I was thinking, I totally forgot this story, but it was sold out, packed, because they were really taking off, and it was upstairs. And like when the kids were dancing to the band, you could feel the floor just rocking, you know, it's almost scary. But the coolest part of the story is Dr. Henry Morgenthaler actually came to the show.
Oh, no way.
He was standing at the corner of the stage. I don't know if he saw us play, but he was there definitely for Me, Mom. And he was there with, I think, his family or something. And he was just sort of sitting there grooving out to the band. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah. So,
that is amazing.
But it's a pretty good story that popped in my head recently when I was thinking back.
Now, you also mentioned, touring a lot. I mean, was that just going back and forth across Canada? How often would you tour, and, you know, how long would those tours be? I mean, would they just be, and who would you go with? I mean, would you just go by yourselves, and, or would you hook up with another Canadian band? And
yeah, I think for the most part, we would go out, it'd be about a month, and mostly across Canada. We did do some American stuff. And most of the time we went alone and just hooked up with bands in local local bands and cities. With the exception of the Ripcords tour, of course, and then the Smugglers. But the rest of the time, I would say we did it on our own. We did a little tour on the East Coast of the U.S. with friends of ours, another pop-punk band called Doc Hopper. I think they're originally from Boston. Anyway, so we were able to do that one time. And we also had a really good friend in Burlington, Vermont, Brad, who has a really great website, by the way, Bradley's Almanac. It's a great music archive. And he lives in Boston now. And he used to do festivals in Burlington, Vermont, which is actually really close to us here. Hmm. It's a short drive down there. So we would go over the border and play there a lot. That was sort of it's funny to think it's another little town, but they had such a thriving scene, and he used to get some pretty amazing bands. And so it was good to have those connections nearby, so we didn't have to go on these massive tours like to try to get to Seattle. Yeah. You know, and I mean, even Boston is only 8 hours from here. It's not that far. But we only played there the one time.
As you put out more material, did you see like the crowds getting bigger, or the crowds knowing the songs, or did you see any kind of correlation between how long you guys have been doing it to how many people are now coming out to the shows?
Yeah, I think so. If I remember correctly, it was always hit and miss like anything else with tours like that. You know, you play some nights are pretty dismal, and the other nights are packed and amazing. I think it really depended on where. Like, I remember Sault Ste. Marie, for example, up in Northern Ontario. There's like every time we play there, it would be packed and awesome, and because there just wasn't a lot of bands, I guess, that stopped and played there. So when you did play, it was like an event. Whereas in some of the bigger cities, something like Toronto or Vancouver, it's much more difficult if you're not on a good bill, right? Like, I think we played one of our last shows in Vancouver was with Bum, who are an incredible band, like one of my favorite bands, and Teen Generate from Japan. So we got on that bill, and that was amazing. Like, it was, you know, packed house. But it would just depend, really, I would say, on what the bill was, what the city was.
So as the decade came to a close, your last record you released in 2000, was there a conversation to slow things down, to end the band, or go on hiatus or something of that nature?
You know, there was never a conversation, and we never ended the band. Like I said, we played a couple of shows in the last while. We're still friends. It's just, I think around the time Good on the River came out, we did a little tour to support it. And then everybody was just doing different things at that time. Both Doug and Glenn were starting families, and everyone just had different priorities. And so I think the first solo record that I did was songs that I was writing that would have been the next Stand record. And then I got busy. I did a couple of solo records, and then I started Camp Radio, which is, you know, similar style of music. And so I got busy with that for a few years. So I think we were just, everybody was just doing different things. It wasn't that we said, this is over or anything, you know?
Yeah.
And then time just races by, and yeah. we're 20 years later. We haven't recorded music in 20 years, but it's been awfully fun playing the shows. Like, we had a couple of great shows in the last 2 years, and it's fun to revisit these songs. And it was amazing to me how easy it was. Like, we literally rehearsed once or twice and then get on stage. It's a little terrifying, but it's amazing. We toured so much and played the song so much, it is like riding a bike, you know. So that was a lot of fun. So I can see us getting together in the future doing that again. I don't know if we'll record new songs or not, but I know Glenn Drummer, he lives about 8 hours away, so he's quite a piece away from the rest of us. Colin's here in Ottawa with me, and Doug is the only one still back in Glengarry.
Oh, cool.
And Doug is really, like, his passion is bluegrass. He plays in a bluegrass band, and that's sort of his thing, right? But yeah, it's always fun to get together and play these songs, even if it's just to hang out and play. We enjoy doing that too. So yeah, I don't think the band ever will say it's over, right, for that reason, because we're friends first.
You mentioned Glengarry. Something that I think I read about back in the day, did you guys have to get people to phone some sort of feedlot or something and have the messages relayed to you guys? Or
I know what you're talking about. That's a bio that Grant Lawrence wrote for the Mint record that we did. a Crackle fan. Yeah. I don't know if it's inside the record or on the back.
Oh yeah. That's, I was reading on the Mint website then. That's where I read it. Yeah. So what's the story behind that? Is it all bullshit, or is that some truth to that?
It's all bullshit. It's just Grant making fun of us. Yeah. It's really funny if you read it. It's just like, yeah, it was all bullshit. Just Grant coming up with something goofy to poke fun at us.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because I think we did the cover, but I think the back cover, Grant's on the back cover, if I remember correctly. And it's a funny picture of Doug sleeping, or I don't know, maybe he's wearing a jacket. Anyway, we got the front cover done. A friend of ours, Brock, did that artwork. But then Mint did the rest of it, and it was all Grant. So he designed that. He put Doug on the back cover. And then I think on the inside, there's an inside sleeve where Grant's, there's a photo of him as well. So all of that was, yeah, it was them, which was pretty funny.
All right. Well, we'll start to wind this down soon. You've have, you know, a ton of solo material out there now. So you've never stopped recording and never stopped playing and never stopped writing. Is there a song that, you know, is really reflective of your solo career that you'd like to talk about?
In terms of a song, yeah, there's a lot out there. I mean, lately I've always wanted to make an acoustic record. So the last record I did, Decide to Stay and Swim Again, is that. I recorded it at home, and it's very acoustic based. And it's not necessarily because I don't like playing rock and roll or pop punk anymore. It's just that my solo stuff has really gravitated towards that acoustic stuff. So, you know, I would say maybe something off that new record would be, you know, what I'm pretty focused on now. Sure.
tectonic false alarms. I'm focused on the past and waiting here for you. I caught a cold for this new year, so can I hang my jacket here? Finish off this toast.
Volume versus voice, that one as well is quite acoustic and mellow.
All right, so I have a companion playlist on Apple and Spotify of all 90s can rock, and I'm asking the guests to contribute two singles and one deep cut of their 90s material. So how would you like the Stan GT to be represented on the playlist?
Well, I would suggest for the two songs, the two whatever we call it, main songs. Number one would be The Wait from Blur Your Cool. That song is, you know, we always play it. It's the song that I think a lot of people gravitate towards. When we played in Seattle recently, you know, everyone was singing it when we played it. It's just, it's definitely a one of my favorites. Doug wrote it, but I think it's one of our best. The other one I think is Away From Your Sway, another Doug song, and I think it's, there's two versions, but the Apocalypse Cow one I'm thinking is a cool version. That song is another one that was really a big song for us to get us rolling and get us on our way. So yeah, I would say those two. And then I was trying to think of I came up with a couple for Deep Cut, and it's funny because Crank Down the Window was one of them.
Nice.
It's funny you should mention that. And then the other one I thought, So I'm Good on the River, Blank the All Stars, is another, would be a good deep cut. I listened to that one this morning as well. And I was like, oh, yeah, because I don't remember really ever playing that live.
Huh.
I'm pretty sure we played Crank Down the Window live, but yeah. So anyway, those are a couple deep cuts you could choose from.
Well, if I'm breaking the tie, I'm going Crank, man. That's one of my
Yeah.
Well, if I'm the tiebreaker, man, I'm going Crank.
So. Yeah, for sure. Go for Crank.
Cool.
Sounds good.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me this morning, man. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, this has been really great. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for doing the podcast. I'm looking forward to diving into doing some listening.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Raven Drool. Please support the podcast by visiting patreon.com/ravedrool. Follow or subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to this. And if you listen to this on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating and review. If you're looking for more 90s can rock content, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. And lastly, if you're looking for music, we have an official playlist on Apple and Spotify. Currently, it's curated by myself with tracks that I've selected. But as you heard during today's episode, eventually it'll be curated by the guests themselves. Until next time, friends, take care.